Good evening and welcome to this very special event of the Middle East Center. We are gathered here to celebrate the publication of the new book by Eugene Vergen. I'm Avi Schlein, and for me it's a pleasure, it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to chair this event, because Eugene is one of my oldest and dearest friends. He's also my co-editor for War for Palestine, rewriting the history of 1948. And most importantly, he's very useful to me, because I can always say that some of my best friends are Americans.
Have you heard before?
Eugene and I have done many double acts in the Middle East Center in the last 33 years. Some of them were quite fun. On one occasion, I was chairing and he was giving a talk, but I forgot I was chairing, so I started answering the questions until Eugene stepped in and said, "Are there any more questions for Professor Schlein?" We also have a long tradition of interrupting one another. But today we agreed that I'll speak for 30 minutes and he'll speak for 10 minutes. I told you we interrupt one another. So, you're quite right. It's the other way around. I'll speak for about 10 minutes and Eugene then will speak about his book for about 30 minutes.
And Avi speaking for 10 minutes is a first, so mark your diaries.
I better keep an eye on the watch. But more seriously, I want to take this opportunity to offer a very broad overview of Eugene's development as a scholar since he came to Oxford 33 years ago. I can only speak about Eugene in the most glowing terms, and I know he's going to be embarrassed because he's really modest. In this respect, he's unlike Uncle Joe, aka Joseph Stalin. When they published an article about Stalin in Pravda, they always gave him the draft of the article, and usually he scribbled at the bottom, "They forgot to mention my modesty." Eugene came to Oxford for an interview for a lectureship in Middle East history in 1990. I was a member of the selection committee. At that time, Eugene did not have his PhD. He was still doing a PhD at Harvard. But he gave a very good talk, and also he displayed platinum-grade social skills. One other candidate on the shortlist was a well-established professor who had published a great deal. And Eugene said to us, had he known that Professor X was a candidate, he wouldn't have applied. And this went down very well, went down well with us. I've been a university teacher for 53 years, and I can honestly say that Eugene was the best academic appointment in which I have been involved. Eugene has authored 4 books. I've written endorsements for the last 3 books. And I think that I know Eugene's work better than anyone, with the possible exception of his wife, Nairi Woods, who is also an old friend of mine, because we both came to Oxford in 1987. She as a Rhodes Scholar from New Zealand, and I as the Alistair Buchan Leader in International Relations, and Nairi was in my first MPhil class. Eugene's first book, based on his Harvard PhD, is called The Frontiers of the State in the Late Ottoman Empire. The book won 2 prizes. One of them was the Albert Hourani Prize. the pioneering work in Ottoman historiography. It shifts the focus from the center to the periphery. It's a very highly original piece of scholarship which uses the full panoply of primary sources in Arabic, Ottoman, Turkish, and French. It also upends the conventional wisdom on the subject. The conventional wisdom says that the foundations of the Jordanian state was laid after the First World War by Britain and its Hashemite allies. Eugene shows that the foundations of the Jordanian state were laid by the Ottomans in the late Ottoman period. According to the British view, there was nothing in Transjordan before they arrived. And it's a title I suggested to you at the time was, it was a black hole, and a title I suggested was not a black hole. But very wisely he declined this title. The second book was The Arabs, A History. This covers 5 centuries of Arab history, and it displays great erudition, wisdom, and empathy. Western scholars often write about the Middle East from the outside looking in. And in my own discipline, international relations, Western scholars often write about the local actors as if they were mere driftwood on the sea of international affairs. The thing about Eugene's book is that he gives the Arabs agency. And another merit of the book is that it's not only his view of Arab history, but Arab views of their own history. So the Middle East Center has produced 2 classic general histories of the region. One was Albert Hourani, A History of the Arab Peoples, and the other is Eugene's book, The Arabs, A History. The 4th book is The Fall of the Ottomans, which was a bestseller and was translated into many languages. How many foreign languages, Eugene?
Between all the books, it's 18.
18. How impressive. Truly impressive to reach a global audience and to have your work translated into 18 languages. But it's not surprising because this book is a very gripping account of the First World War from the vantage point of the Ottoman Empire. It combines deep scholarship with a very lively narrative style, which makes it a pleasure to read. Eugene's publishers asked me to write an endorsement, so they sent me an uncorrected proof copy. And for 4 days, I sat in an armchair in my study. I didn't look at my emails, and I just read the book from cover to cover. And it's a complex story, but he tells it with great clarity. And one thing that was particularly striking was the skill with which he related developments on the battlefield to great power diplomacy. And the 4th book is the one we are celebrating today, the Damascus events. Once again, the publishers asked me for an endorsement and sent me an uncorrected proof copy. And what's remarkable about this is that usually uncorrected proof copies are riddled with mistakes which are corrected later. But in this case, I didn't detect a single misprint or typo. It was completely perfect and a tribute to his meticulous scholarship. Margaret Macmillan also wrote an endorsement to this book. I'm very glad to see her here, but I won't ask you to stand up because everybody knows you since you were the former warden of this college. And Margaret is also my dearest cousin. This is what she wrote in her endorsement. In the hands of the distinguished historian and master storyteller, Eugene Rogan, an incident of communal violence in Damascus in 1860 is at once an evocation of the vanished world of the Ottoman Empire and an ominous foreshadowing of the communal violence tearing apart the Middle East today, unquote. I couldn't have put it better myself. So this completes my introduction, and I now call on Eugene to tell us about his book in his own words, and please welcome him.
Avi, thank you so much for the ritual embarrassment that you just put me through. I blushed on multiple occasions, but you know, I expected nothing less. I meant to warn you all, there should be a warning that comes on the poster every time you come to an event with Avi chairing me or vice versa, that it just can be a little bit unpredictable. And I think, Avi, that you've demonstrated in your very generous introduction just how unpredictable the direction of travel can be when you and I share a stage. It's so lovely to see you all. And there is always a sense when you do a book launch under this roof of a kind of family event, a family gathering. So I just want you to know that I went and put my best suit on. You know, I got a haircut. I want to make sure I was like properly dusted off before I came before you today. Because we're talking about a book which really does sort of stand out as a defining project of my entire time here. This is the book that's taken 35 years to materialize. And as you'll see, for those of you who've got the book and you open the first pages, it starts back when I was a graduate student, back in 1989, on a visit to the American Archives, when I went to consult consular papers from Jerusalem and Damascus, that I stumbled on three volumes of Arabic handwritten reports by the first American vice consul to Damascus, a man celebrated in his own time as the smartest or the best educated man in the Arab world. His name was Mikhail Mishaka. He's well known for a history he wrote in Arabic, the title of Jawab al-Iqtirah al-Ahbab, or the response to the suggestion of the loved ones, rendered in its brilliant English translation by Harvard scholar Wheeler Thaxton, under the slightly more salacious murder, mayhem, pillage, and plunder. But it's a history of Syria and Lebanon in the 18th and 19th century. And so Mishaka was a known quantity as I went to the archives to go and look up his reports. And I was very disappointed when the archivist was unable to bring them out of the stacks for me. And to make a long story short, I got an interview to go behind the scene into the stacks. By the way, if ever you're in the American Archives, and you get the chance, take it. Because seeing the miles of shelving is in many ways even more impressive than the sort of neoclassical exteriors of the buildings in which these archives are housed. So it was fun. And there, tucked away under all these sort of great big leather-bound volumes were these three locally sourced notebooks. And I realized I found the missing volumes. And probably was the first person to consult them since they'd been repatriated from Damascus to the archives in DC. For all I knew, the last person to turn the pages would have been Mikhail Mishaka or his son Nassif, who succeeded him as American vice consul. And I was literally shaking with excitement as I took these volumes back into the reading room of the archive, because I knew that I'd kind of stumbled on the thing that archival historians dream of, but almost never have happened to them, which is finding lost material in the archive. And what a treasure trove it was. I recognize, starting in 1859, just on the eve of the violence that is the center of this book, that his would prove to be the most important new documentation on a story that was, well, deeply rooted, and so one of those subjects that would be of perennial interest. It was, as it turns out, of no use to my doctor. There was nothing there on Ottoman experiences in Transjordan, the subject of that first book. But I came away, I photocopied every single page, knowing that Damascus was my second book project. Any, you know, ambitious doctoral candidate thinking about what they want to do to secure tenure is thinking about the second book project already there. I had it in the Mishaka reports from the American Archives. So this was the project that I brought to Oxford in 1991 to take up the post that Avi and his colleagues very kindly offered me.
to Albert Hirani's Middle East Center, a center where Albert was very present, still came every Thursday, every week in term time. So someone that I really had the chance to spend time with and get to know. And in that first year I was here, Leila Fawaz was just finishing up the manuscript for her book on the Damascus and Lebanese events, An Occasion for War. I remember offering her my Mishaka material, since I was still deeply mired in trying to publish my own doctorate. And Leila didn't take me up on it. You realize when you get to the end of a manuscript, the last thing you want is three volumes of new sources to read your way through and try and integrate into your book. But she will always give me credit for being a very generous, collaborative scholar. Don't believe a minute of it. Anyway, so, and yes, this was very much the Albert Hirani Center, where the history option that I inherited from Albert, as you all know, many of you from recent personal experience, the modern history of the Middle East starts in 1860 in Oxford. So this was the project that I was very excited to be moving on to. But I still had to publish that doctorate. And for those of you who are currently in that stage of turning dissertations into books, I'm not looking at anyone in particular. It took me 7 years. So, you know, patience and hope for good things to come from it.
It was worth waiting for.
Thank you, Avi. He's biased. He likes Jordan, too. But when the book came out in 1999, that cleared my desk for me to begin to tackle the Damascus Project. So I started reading Mishaka's reports. And, you know, they're written in a little notebook in a very crabbed hand. They're hard going. The language is very much the language of 19th century Damascus. Already that creates a sort of opening into a lost world. You're having to adapt to a different turn of phrase, a different language. And I had so much to learn about the people and the institutions and the places of Damascus through those reports. But I was working my way through the published primary sources, all the secondary literature. And the thing about this topic that was so, on the one hand, daunting, but on the other hand, exciting, was that this is a subject where you really get to stand on the shoulders of giants. When I look at the scholars who have worked on 1860 events in Mount Lebanon and in Damascus, I really got to draw on the best. To name, obviously starting with Albert Hirani himself, but Kamal Salibi, the great historian of modern Lebanon, Abdul Karim Rafik, the great historian of Ottoman Syria, Philip Houri, my co-supervisor at Harvard, Leila Fawaz herself, a real mentor figure to me all of her time at Tufts, more recent scholars like my colleague Najwa Al-Khattan, Osama Al-Maqdisi, obviously, and many, many more. But when you approach this subject, you really do it with an ability to engage with a body of literature. It's quite rare in modern Middle Eastern history, actually. We're still filling in so many gaps that it's quite a joy to stumble into one of these areas where there is such depth. I secured faculty funding to go, after getting into this project, for a couple of weeks research in Damascus itself. And it was such a pleasure to be able to go into the archives in the daytime hours, to walk the streets where it all happened after archival hours, and then spend late nights in the very rich library holdings of the French Institute in Damascus. Dawn, you'll remember it well, and any of you who've been working in Damascus before the current civil war shattered normal life like scholarship and research. So it gave me this chance to do a deep dive engagement, but it was while I was there in Damascus at the Institute that I first learned of the Al-Qaeda attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania. For that was the 11th of September, 2001. And in a sense, the events of 9/11 were to, in some way, get intertwined with my experience with this book and this story. I left Damascus that night, and it was a bizarre experience of going to the airport, bags in hand, no ticket, trying to wheedle a ticket out of the airlines as every single international flight, particularly those coming from the West, canceled, canceled, canceled. And you realize that this was going to be one of those moments that was going to change the world, and indeed it did. It also changed my research program, but there we go. Having left Damascus that night, I was at Mesa the following year in a panel organized by our former student Martin Bunton. Roger Owen was on it. It was thinking about what scholars should be doing in light of the attacks of 9/11 and the emergence of an American-led war on terror that had put the Arab and Islamic worlds in the crosshairs. And there was a sense that we academics needed to play a more public role. And my own idea there was to put Damascus down and to try and write a general history, not the Arab world instead, to try and give English readers a sense of modern Arab history as it's been experienced through Arab lives and Arab eyes, which is the genesis of the Arabs. So I put Damascus down, wrote the Arabs, and that was followed by the fall of the Ottomans. I need say no more on that since Avi has spoken so generously about that. And it's only now, after decades, that I finally got the liberty to return to a project that, to be honest, I've never lost my excitement over since I first came across those reports lost to the archive way back in 1989. It's a different book today than what I would have written had I written it back in 2001, 2002. Syria is a different place. If I think of what might have influenced the interpretive lens I would bring to bear on my subject, you know, I would have spoken in the early 2000s about the success of Ottoman initiatives to spare Syria a sectarian order. Syria had other problems. It had authoritarianism, it had Ba'athism, it had an intolerance of political dissent that had political prisoners in jail. It had had very violent encounters with the Muslim Brotherhood that led to devastations of whole urban quarters. Hama comes to mind in 1982. Post-2011, had I come at the subject in light of the current civil war in Syria, it would instead be about a return of sectarianism, about a country that fragmented very much along the lines of communities, and those communities in different coalitions, either for or against the government, and each being driven by their greater fear. So many Christian communities throwing their lot in with the regime, murderous as it is, of Bashar al-Assad, because their greater fear were the Salafis, who had been exterminationist towards minority communities, and they all had stories about the horrors that they had suffered at the hands of their enemies. So a very divided and very sectarian Syria that emerged as a consequence. But even there, you know, what could you say about 1860 that is relevant to Syria today? I hope there is something in this book that will stand as a valuable lesson still about the ways that one can rebuild society even after deeply divisive horror. But as I say that with the recognition that the scale is so different. In the story I tell you, in 1860, 1,500 houses were destroyed in a week of carnage. It was unprecedented violence. And you'll smell the smoke coming from the pages as you read the accounts of those who survived that horror. So I don't mean to downplay it, but the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights gives a figure between 2011 and 2018, so already 6 years ago, of 3 million houses partially or totally destroyed across Syria in this war. You know, 1,500? 3 million, you do the maths. So it's very hard to know if there is indeed hope in the story of a Syria renascent that might allow Syrians to take from this experience a vision of how they might yet reconstitute civil society. In the end, as I read through the material, it was the analysis of the events as a genocidal moment, where the Christian communities in both Mount Lebanon and in Damascus, for very different reasons, had come to be seen to represent an existential threat. And faced with that Christian threat, extermination seemed a reasonable solution in both Mount Lebanon and in Damascus. So this concept of a genocidal moment, I distinguish a genocidal moment from one where the intention of the crowd is to exterminate, but they are prevented from fulfilling their objectives, as happens in Damascus. 85% of the Christians will survive the events in 1860. No spoiler alert here. From an event in which the casualty toll takes it beyond a point where extermination is actually being achieved to some degree. So a genocidal moment versus a genocide. And it's that theme which seems to have made this book more relevant since the events of the 7th of October. But there it's less how might Syria recover from what it's done since 2011 to how might a society once taken to the brink by deeply divisive trauma draw back from that brink. And so I think that is the takeaway lesson
for the book as it was to come out, written at this moment in history, at this time in history. There is horror in the Damascus events, but there is hope too. Beyond questions of the present relevance of writing this story, there was also just the sheer pleasure of seizing the opportunity to write about a city whose history is so rich and whose society is so rich and diverse as 19th century Damascus. And that deep dive was just so satisfying. This fascinating city seen through the eyes of very diverse contemporaries, starting with Mishaka, my main source, who is himself, you know, as I said, he is described by his contemporaries as the smartest, best educated man in the Arab world. And he is in so many ways an intellectual force. He's a polymath, he's an autodidact. He's a man of very strong views and very strong opinions. So you have this kind of exalted notion of the man, but you know, he married a 12-year-old. Hello. And as I'm going through his list of lost property in the course of the events, I learn that our enlightened convert to Protestantism through the efforts of the American missionaries himself was a slave owner. And he's trying to desperately claim the money back for the slave of his that was stolen and impregnated, and he didn't want her back anymore. And you're trying to reconcile all these different elements of a complex personality who would fit so badly in our times and was so admired in his own times. So to be able to be taken on a tour of 19th century Damascus by people like Mishaka was part of what made this such an exciting project for me. But not just Mishaka. There have been a host of accounts by leading Muslim notables that have emerged in the years since the last major scholarship. People like, well, Kamal Salimi published the diary of Al-Hasibi. Most people only focus on what he had to say about the events itself, but he was thrown in jail for a year as part of the clampdown. And those accounts, I've never seen anyone really delve into. And for the crime and punishment side of our story, you know, Hasibi's account was absolutely breathtaking. And he is himself, or he was a sharif, a member of a family that descended traced its lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad. In the early 20th century, he'll actually rise to become the Natib al-Ashraf, or the head of the guild of those descendants of the Prophet Muhammad in the city of Damascus. So in Hasibi, wonderful to get his take. Also published in the 1990s, that of the preacher of the venerable Umayyad Mosque, a man by the name of Al-Ustawani. Again, very venerable Sunni family of Damascus. And his records, going right back to 1840, are just quirky. They tell you funny things about the city and society. The things that he chose as newsworthy to record were in themselves very telling about the man and his character. And so, you know, getting these rich characters, Ottoman officials like Fuad Pasha, you know, going to the Ottoman archives and reading through the reports filed at the time, Fuad was writing huge, long reports that are just full of wonderful details about the very delicate balancing act he is making, trying to walk a path between bringing order back to Damascus and keeping the European powers from intervening forcefully at the expense of Ottoman sovereignty. The governors of Damascus as well. I would say one of the novelties of this book compared to the other ones I've written is this cast of rich characters. They all knew each other. They all crossed paths, they counter-reference each other, and they stay with you in the book right through to the end. In fact, when I get to the conclusion, I say goodbye to each one of them as they pass away under circumstances that leaves you feeling a little nostalgic for the passing of a Damascus that they represented that was now gone and finished, but that they were nonetheless, as survivors of 1860, able to pass on to the next generation a better future. And in that, I suppose, we find that there is hope to the story here of survival that I hope that you will all find makes reading the book a pleasure. It does have a rough beginning, but it does have a happy ending. Bringing out a book, of course, is a complex work that involves debts to a lot of people. I'm going to start with the first people I turn to with the book idea, and that's my agents, Catherine Clark and Michelle Topham here at Felicity Bryan Agency, and George Lucas of the States, did just a wonderful job in finding the very best publishers for the book in both Britain
and in the United States. And I say that to bring a blush to Simon Winterscheek, who's here with us tonight, who took the book for Alan Lane Penguin and really marshaled it through against the skepticism of a publisher who, supportive of my writing, still worried that this book might be more academic or monographic than a trade book meant for the general readership. And I wanted to publish with Penguin Alan Lane more than anybody else, and for the vote of confidence, Simon, I'm really grateful. And it's so exciting to see the book out and so beautiful. So, but I would say the same to Laura Heimert from Basic Books, Were She Here? And to her, or to your colleagues, I say, Annabelle Huxley here at Penguin and Liz Wetzel, who are the people who get you the opportunity to do that article with the FT, or the interviews, or the time on radio, or the book reviews. So it's just, it's such a pleasure and such a joy to get to work with these publishing houses who now, this is my third book with both Basic and with Penguin, and what a lucky man I am. I would like to then thank those who floated my book even before it was out with pre-publication endorsements. Avi already read Margaret Macmillan's. Avi's is no less generous. We are, if you like, a confederacy of scoundrels. The way that we all sing the praises of each other's books. I think this is more of an American thing. Every time I told Simon and Annabelle about the endorsers that Basic had lined up, they kept groaning, saying, but they would have been such good book reviewers. But that pre-publication vote of confidence makes me blush, but it's so lovely to see, and I want to thank Margaret, and I want to thank Avi, but also Simon Sebag Montefiore, Peter Frankopan in America, as well as wonderful academic friends and colleagues like Libby Thompson at American, Leila Fawaz at Tufts, and Samuel Dwyer, one of the young doyen of Damascene historians. So lovely of Sammy to give the seal of approval. Very nice if you presume to write about someone else's country, someone else's city, but then to say that it's okay what you've done. This is such an Oxford book. Every book I've written has been an Oxford book. With supportive colleagues, and I want to thank Walter, and I want to thank Mariam, and I want to thank Rehan, who've been here this year, but also Michael and Laurent and Neil, who have abandoned us for greener pastures as they go on sabbatical. And I want to thank our amazing students. You're here in strength, and as I said, you know from experience that the modern history of the Middle East begins in 1860. So this is very much for you. I want to thank my kids. You'll see some beautiful flowers there. But Richard and Isabel couldn't be here today in person, and I think they've chosen the most beautiful way to be here in spirit. So I want to thank Richard and Izzy as part of tonight. Saving my most important for last. Get out your handkerchiefs. Because this book is dedicated to Nairi for a good reason. Her support over the years, whenever I traveled to do the research and the writing, if I was galloping off for a couple of weeks in Damascus, or went trotting off to Istanbul, or indeed, when I decided to spend a whole sabbatical year in Toulouse, and I got your fulsome support and regular visits to make sure I didn't feel too lonesome and wonderful encouragement all the way through. And then it's just a genuine interest you've taken in this subject from the very beginning, Nairi. The regular conversations, the feedback on the early chapters, always encouraging, always positive. You learned a long time ago that what we really want to hear is not the things we could get better, but that it's really brilliant. If this book has been 35 years in the making, Nairi, you've been my inspiration for the past 31 of them. So thank you, Nairi. This one's for you. Publication date in the UK was last Thursday. Very exciting. And in the Americas, it was yesterday. But today, here, in the Middle East Center, the book is launched. I wish it well. And I thank you for all of your good wishes.
could have a conversation.
Are you going to be civil or are you going to embarrass me?
Very, very highly civil. So let's have a conversation.
All right.
But I want to thank you first for the fascinating account that you have given us of the writing of this book, the making of this book, over a very long period of time. It was a really, truly interesting account. And you also spoke in a very engaging way about the process of writing history and the joys of writing history, particularly archival research. And you struck really lucky with these files. But one of the excitements about working in an archive is that you never know when you might hit something really big and important. But it's a real joy. And I've lectured in this room to the Enfield students about archival research. And I always say what a joy it is. And I don't know what young people do these days for fun. They probably go clubbing. If I had to choose between going clubbing and working in an archive, I would choose working in an archive anytime. It's a no-brainer.
But you've had big discoveries in the archive. And if I think about your collusion across the Jordan, you were one of the fortunate few to get access to material that other scholars had never seen before, and can blow the lid off the first Arab-Israeli war and the genesis of the state of Israel. So you know all about this from firsthand.
It was all in the Israeli archives. My first book was called Collusion Across the Jordan, King Abdullah, the Zionist Movement, and the Partition of Palestine. And Israel has a state archive and a 30-year rule which governs the review and declassification of official documents. Israel copied the British 30-year rule and used to apply it very, very liberally. And Benny Morris, Ilan Pape, and I were the beneficiaries of this liberal policy. But Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't like critical history, so he closed down the reading room in the state archives, and now you can only apply online. And you have to know what you are applying for, which takes away all the fun of working in an archive and ordering physical files. So when I worked on the book on King Abdullah, everything was there. There were a series of secret meetings, and there were about three or four or five different Israeli accounts of what happened at these meetings. And I, as a diplomatic historian, simply reconstructed not just what was decided, but what the atmosphere, the ambience, and what was discussed and what was decided at these secret meetings. So this is, and the result was collusion across the Jordan.
Can I pause you for one second there? I just wanted to know if anybody had any questions for Professor Schlein.
I set you up for that one.
Okay. So I want to make one other comment about the end, the last part of your talk, which is thanking people, the acknowledgements. It's what I call the end of a jumble sale kind of a speech. That's when the headmaster thanks everybody who helped to organize the jumble sale. And you did it very elegantly. But I particularly want to highlight your thanks to the students. And I want to associate myself with the thanks to our students, to our brilliant students. And if you're an academic, there are two things in which you can distinguish yourself, as a scholar and as a teacher. And you have distinguished yourself, you have excelled in both. And the Christopher Hill, the Marxist historian who was the master of Balliol College, once said, "If we are not here for the students, what the hell are we here for?"
Well, I don't think the students have ever let go of you. So the question of the students is, do you still allow Avi to be associated with you? I mean, he wants to associate himself with you. Is this allowed?
And can I ask you a serious question?
I don't promise you a serious answer.
You've written four history books. Do you have a philosophy of history? Do you have an overarching view of what history is about? The purpose of history, and anything about methodology, because some eminent historians have written books towards the end of their career reflecting on the writing of history. There is E.H. Carr, his Reith lectures were called What is History? Geoffrey Elton from Cambridge wrote The Historian's Craft. Richard Evans from Cambridge, his book is called In Defense of History. And our own Margaret Macmillan wrote a book on the uses and abuses of history. So what is your general view about the philosophy of history and historiography?
It's a really interesting question, Avi, because I'm not philosophical about history. And I've got a very short attention span. Seriously. So it's got to keep my interest. And I think a lot of readers are that way, too. So, I mean, to me, it's the human connection in history that's always driven it for me, which is why I so enjoy reading first-person narratives, and why I always like going back to those who lived through the events to try and get the insights that come with eyewitness experience. I'm a narrative historian. I'm not a theoretical or abstract historian. I'm not a structuralist. I've never really bought into large frameworks of history. I don't say that in any way dismissively, because most of the great historians in our field do just that. And in that sense, you know, I will fail the academy in never having put forward a big theoretical approach that is innovative in history in some way that others would imitate. You know, at that level, I'm not a contributor. But I think I write history that people can see the relevance to the world as it is today. I was interviewed by one of my undergraduates for Cherwell recently, the student newspaper, and I made a throwaway line about, you know, the whole point is, if you want to understand the mess we're in today, you've got to know some history. And what I write is kind of grounded in the present relevance of history being how it helps us to understand the issues of the present, the options moving forward, the lessons from the past, both things you might want to do and things you absolutely want to avoid doing. But it's not a very rigorous theoretical or philosophical approach to history, if I'm honest.
I recommend, following on from these comments, I recommend to all of you the essay that Eugene published in the FT, the weekend FT, the 4th of May, on the lessons of history for the modern Middle East. Mm. And you'll see how well he uses this approach of how well he uses history in order to explain current events. So this is something that, you know, it was a trick question to ask you about it. Because we are, you know, this is something we have in common, that we are not organized and obsessed with methodology. We are narrative historians. In my case, I'm a simple storyteller. But I used to be in the Department of International Relations with NIRI, and the Director of Research in International Relations, the Director of Research Training, asked me to give a lecture, a two-hour graduate seminar on my research methodology. And I said, I need 30 seconds. My research methodology is to collect all the material on my topic and to write it up. So this is one thing we have in common. And the other thing that we have in common is that we were both born on the 31st of October.
Yeah. As was Zaha Hadid, who gave us this lecture theater. Yeah, 31 October, it's a powerful day.
And on this note, I'll bring the formal proceedings, not so formal proceedings, to an end. And there is a book sale in the foyer. I'm going to ask you to stay in your seats to allow Eugene to walk out and to sit down, and he'll be able to sign a copy of his book to anyone who buys it. Now, I very, very strongly recommend this book. It's the best book I've read since Middlemarch. possibly even since the middle of February.
Oh!